Welcome to the Edinburgh Fringe Show. In this episode, a comedian, a filmmaker, a director, and a triathlete. Yes, good afternoon, good morning, good evening. The rain is thundering down here in Edinburgh because it's July and it's summer. But after the summer comes the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. So let's have a little look forward to the biggest art show in the world. Oh, also the rain doesn't stop. It will be raining in August as well. So consider that the first of many little moments in this preview. Yes, hello everybody. Ewan Spence here, calling you from Edinburgh as we look forward to the Edinburgh Fringe arriving here in Scotland's capital city. There is a lot to go on in August and we're never able to capture all of it in the podcast. There is just literally far too many. You're talking about 3,500 to 4,000 shows, all those curtain calls, all those performers, so much going on. But we can bring you a flavour. And that's what we're going to do today. This is the preview, so it's basically to get you in the mood for the Fringe. It's a longer interview, and it goes into many different spaces. I'm going to meet a South Indian performer, Anu Vaidyanathan. She's in her second year at the Fringe with a show called Blimp. Now, in the Fringe Guide, it describes this as a woman filmmaker's view of the world as Anu attempts to survive between the world's action and cut. It's a comic tale of a full-time mother with part-time attempts at sanity, sewing, and show business. As we said at the top of the show, as a comedian, a filmmaker, a director, and sometimes triathlete. The show itself starts on August the 2nd, finishes on August the 19th, with performances at 7:15 every day at the Underbelly. But before we get to the capital, before you get to the capital, if you're coming up to Edinburgh, settle in. I chat with Anu Vaidyanathan. Joining me now on the Edinburgh Fringe podcast show, whatever we are calling this great big thing that's been running forever and ever, Anu Vaidyanathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, it's like sometimes I look at someone's CV and just go, oh, there's one or two interesting things in here. There's a billion interesting things you've got on here of stuff you do. So what does it say in your passport where it has occupation?
It says perennially confused and looking for a home.
You're going to have to explain that one. That's a far better question than I could have ever researched.
Perfect. So I've lived in at least half a dozen countries, lived and worked and studied and raised children in. And I think, you know, whatever it is we are called on this earth to do, I don't think I've done it yet. And so, you know, as long as my mind is ticking and my health allows it and my family isn't too unhappy, I think the greatest privilege I have is just being from the home that I am from, you know. And how I put my work out into the world, it's something that I think about every day. You know, when it comes to relatability, the reason comedy was at all appealing or anything I've done so far is at all appealing is because I think there is a universal truth to human existence. And I'm still finding it through everything that I try to do. So we'll see. We'll see where that leads me.
Yeah. Obviously, the stand-up is part of the Fringe, but you've got filmmaking in there. You've got theatre making in there. You've got being a parent in there. Which is the most important?
I think a lot of my day-to-day is about parenting. I think it's a huge privilege and a huge challenge. As I was speaking with someone last night, I think I was saying that motherhood is the final frontier, you know, or parenting. Let's put it as parenting is the final frontier, especially if you're constantly puzzled, as I am, as to what makes a strong son or a strong daughter. You know, if you're puzzled by that question, which I'm sure many of us are, I think that is a question that would confound even the brightest of minds, you know, and anything else you do will seem to be far easier, you know, than your calling as a parent. So I think, yeah, parenting is for me the biggest thing. Any day of the week, yeah.
So how do you bring in and balance that off with the artistic endeavors that you do?
This is a great question. I think when I've worked as an engineer, and I'm still a jobbing engineer, but I feel, you know, it's taking up less and less of my mind space. And the time that I was a professional athlete, I had to travel, you know, to do anything at all, be it work, be it racing, be it training at high altitude, whatever that required me to do always took me out of the house. And that was okay because I was, you know, I was mostly single through these endeavors. I got married towards the end of my sporting career. But when it comes to the arts, I was also telling a friend last night that it's the only sort of neck of the woods that constantly demands movement. You know, you have to be out there in the world, putting yourself out there, your work out there. And I do think this is a huge stretch for a parent, because it's not something that seems to fit in with the thing you really want to do, which is get the snacks ready for 4 o'clock, or, you know, make sure that they're not eating cakes and chips, or, you know, being neurotic as you will every day. But I think the way I have resolved it is that my first ever artistic endeavor was in writing a book. And that only happened because I got pregnant, you know, and I had to slow down. And when my first baby came along, I realized that children are more naturally drawn to the spoken word, you know, a bright color, you know, or a sound. And I think that was a realization that sort of pushed me into the arts to begin with, right, as a more serious exploration. So I feel like if they were the fountainhead of that creativity, then I'm not going to sort of, you know, use that as a bargaining tool. And every time, you know, my work requires me to travel, I have the privilege of saying that I have a very supportive partner who, you know, who can then sort of help me balance that mind space and say, look, you're in a busy period of work. This is what is happening. And to also say to my kids that, you know, mom and dad are actually equals. You know, it's not just dad who goes out to work and mom who's at home making your snacks. You know, there's also days when it's the other way around. And I'm hoping that that pays off, you know, that pays off in some way a little later. Because I've had a very big career woman for a mom, you know, who never made me feel less or more for her job, or made herself feel less or more for that job. So I think those are the things, maybe the way I was raised, it sort of emboldens me to try that with my own kids.
So the modeling that your parents gave to you, you're now modeling for your children as well.
Yes, I think so. And I don't hold myself to the same expectations because we're a different generation with different pressures. So I know I'm a very different parent than my mom, but I feel like at least I don't have to sort of create a void in myself to fulfill another role, you know. I think that is a danger that even the most educated of us, the most privileged of us, face every day. It's a stereotype we have for ourselves as women, you know, or as caretakers. And I feel like having seen my mom overcome that in her own very soft, quiet, underspoken way sort of helps me think about my creative life as something that it's a gift. And so, you know, don't take it too seriously and don't let it, you know, screw everything up. So kind of thing. Yeah. I don't know if that makes sense.
You mentioned too, it makes a lot of sense, believe me. You mentioned two of the big ticket items there, an engineer and an athlete. I also know you're a filmmaker and you're here as a comic, but the comic is the most recent addition.
Yes, absolutely. I think making art as a woman is a very political thing, especially if you're making films, which is the pinnacle of, you know, the culmination of the arts, if you will, right? You have to you know, think about sound, music, image, light. So I feel like performance, and I feel like being a woman director was something that was a bit of a rude shock for me, at least in my first few outings. I made a dozen short films now, so I'm not exactly new to the game, but I remember the distinct emotional and mental shock that I faced as a first-time film director or a second-time film director. And that continues, you know, because I think in the neck of independent cinema, we are very much leaning in on the kindness of others, on the charity of others to come together and put their best foot forward for the days we are making that film. And I really felt like it was at odds with everything I was raised to believe of myself, you know, because, and I use this in my new show, Blimp, right? I say, as a woman director, the last thing you can do is be direct, you know, because you need to sort of instead play the role of a dream catcher. You know, you're there to sort of only take the cream. And that's very difficult to do because if you're a very emotional person, as you have to be to make anything at all, Even the slightest cruelty can hit hard, and you can't show that it's hit you. So I feel like comedy is a reaction to the fact that I am navigating this new world of having to create something mostly stood in a pit of men, you know, because as much as we may talk about equality, filmmaking is extremely still male dominated, you know, I don't want to be the token diversity candidate, you know, none of the days of the week was I made to believe that that was good enough in my house. So I feel like comedy gives me this stage to say the thing I really want to say. And unapologetically so, you know, and not have to bargain. So yeah, comedy is a wonderful, it's my form of therapy, and I love it.
It sounds like comedy is the place where you, brutal's the wrong word. You can be blunt with people in front of you. And, you know, that you said dream catcher there. And I'm thinking, I don't see your stand-up as being a dream catcher. It's a little bit more forceful.
Yeah, I think a dream catcher, unfortunately, can't have a voice that's the loudest in the room, you know, or you can't be the voice that you're sort of projecting. It can't be your voice. It has to be something of a, you know, I think a woman director is more like a tuning fork, right? You have to find that frequency that fits for that day, for that crew, for that set of actors, and the text that you're trying to bring to life. But I think as a comedian, you're more like a real estate agent, right? You're like, man, this is my show, you know, and here's what I have to say, and screw you if you don't like it, you know? So it's like, okay, you know, just say what you have to say and see where it lands. And if they love you, they love you. On your claps, if they hate you, then you rewrite, you know? So I think it's also a very good way to put your hand into what is the zeitgeist of the times, you know, because I think also being a woman director, how many films can you make in a year? I mean, think about it, you know, writing books or making films, the loop is quite long, you know, it takes months, years to put things together, versus comedy is very quick. It's, you know, it's a very good way to get feedback on whether you're doing good writing also. So as a writer, it really feeds my brain quite a bit to do comedy. So yeah, I love it. And I will continue to do it for as long as I can. I
mean, talking about fast loops there, your comedic loop is quite fast. We're going into your second Edinburgh Fringe show and you're in your second year as a comic. That's pretty fast.
Yeah, I am a very selfish person, I think. But the thing is, I've realized that, you know, the true essence of the Fringe is that you come in with an idea and you leave with a show, you know. And I think that's lost to the mechanics of the business, whatever the business is, and, you know, the mechanics of how you're supposed to present to industry. But I feel like if you've lost that sense of apology, which I did on my first outing, right? I was very naive in my first year. It was the first time I've ever come to Scotland, right? And I thought there were four venues at the Fringe, and I come in and there are 4,000 and a congregation of artistic energy that's enough to make your eyeballs pop. And I'm thinking, Jesus, what did I get into? You know, like, if I didn't have a religion before this, I do now, you know. And I just felt that on the flip side, it made me understand, you know, what Raymond Carver put so eloquently about why you make anything at all. It is to be loved, you know, and to feel any bit of resonance, you know, when anything you say lands on another person's mind, soul, you know, headspace. So I think I found that and it emboldened me, you know, and I felt like if you take anything at all from this experience, it should be that don't differ, you know, don't differ. If you have something to say, if you have an idea, you know, put your whole, put your back into it and see where it leads. It may not be the perfect show on day one, but hopefully by the end of it, you'll have enough of an artistic loop to figure out what you're trying to say in the first place. And that's fine. You said, you know, I was in my second show in my second year. And I think about that a lot. I wonder if, you know, I should have given it another year, especially because this year is pressurizing me in ways I haven't imagined, you know, with other work. And I feel like, yes, I've questioned my decision a couple of times. And I feel always that, if you're sure you have an idea that's worth sharing, right? And you feel like you've put your hours in, right? I've been building Blimp since October last year, to be fair, right? But you know, I know that I will only find the truth in the show with time, you know, even BCAD, I think I've refined it over 70 shows on my tour.
This is the show from the Fringe last year.
Last year's show, yes. And so I feel like every performance is a new one. Every performance is a new room, you know. And I'm not saying that 90% of the show will change, but something will change. So no, definitely come in on the 2nd. But please come back. Please keep coming back till the 19th and hopefully, you know, we find something.
And that's always the thing about the Fringe is that you're doing... You've got your slot to do your show every single day in every comic, every theater, every dancer who comes to the Fringe. Is, you know, shows are living, breathing things, and they evolve as they go through. And I mean, is that like the filmmaking process? Because really, like, once you capture performance on, I was about to say on celluloid, I think that dates me, but you're stuck with that one performance. Whereas with comedy, I mean, how much crossover is there in the discipline?
No, there is. I think, so here's the thing. I believe that film is very limited when it comes to capturing performance. You know, you got that right, you know, because there is no enlivening the same thing the next night. There is no second chance. At most, how many takes can you do? You know, you can do a dozen, two dozen takes. You know, if you have all the money in the world, maybe you can have a 6-month schedule. But that's it. That's your window, you know, and you either get it or you don't. And I feel like theater is far more, I feel it's far, more, it's a far less democratic space, but I feel it's a far more challenging space for a performer or a director or a writer, because, you know, you can absolutely complete the circle, you know, as the great Peter Brook put it, right? You can change that complicity. You can change what you have to say, depending on who's walking into the room. Or how you feel they are reacting to you. So I feel like, theater is far more challenging in those ways. Any form of theater, it could be stand-up, it could be pure drama, whatever. But film is full and final, like you said. The minute it's on, it's, you know, you click off, it's done, right? And there's no, I don't know, unless you're in a 20-part, 15-year running series or something, you know, where you can change all the cast every 6 months. No, but I think this is its own beast, you know. I don't feel like there is. And you asked about crossover. I think good writing is good writing. I think good performance is good performance. I think good directing is good directing. But of course, if you're directing theater, it's a little different than directing film, because in film you also need to have the technical competence of knowing what that visual will do or not do for your audience. You know, if you have that insight, that helps greatly, which I don't need for theater. Because, you know, I could show up in my jeans and my T-shirt and really no one will care as long as what I'm saying is interesting, if it's live, you know. So I think there is a lot of difference, but in terms of what works across both, I think it's the writing and the performance. You can't lose that, you know, whether it's film or theater. So
you said that theater is less democratic.
Absolutely.
What do you mean by that?
Absolutely. You have too many gatekeepers. A person like me cannot make art anywhere as a theater maker. You know, I think I definitely feel that there are a lot more hoops to cross if you want to be a theater maker than if you want to be a filmmaker. Because I think film, look, I'm the last person to say all films should be shot on an iPhone, because I'm also a technical snob. You know, I think that is definitely not what I'm trying to say. But I feel like when it comes to the amount of stuff needed to bring a piece to life, if you have a good relationship with the text, if you know your stuff as a director and you know a couple of friends who'll take pity on you and act in your films, then it's easier to make a piece of film than it is to make theater, because theater has a lot more mechanics of bringing people in every day, seating them, putting on the show, coming out of that show, taking care of your performers, going back. And so, and even to get to those stages where people will actually show up, I don't think that's easy, because we are not, you know, at the end of the day, I think the practice of street theaters is obviously not there anymore. Like, I'm used to a lot of that from South India, you know, where we would have buskers and performers and singers and comedians just show up for, you know, little street kiosks, you know, on the weekends or festivals, or storytelling, verbal storytelling. That's our heritage anyway. But I think, you know, to make theater today, I feel is far more difficult. It's far more difficult than making film in my limited worldview as an independent maker. So And I don't, by that, I don't mean to say that film is any easier. I just mean to say that there are less hoops to jump through. You know, if you know your stuff, if you skill up and you know your stuff, the road feels a little bit more open than if you're making theater. So that's my experience.
You've taken last year's show, BCAD, on tour, as it were, and carried on showing it after the Fringe. And you've got the show at the Fringe. So does the Edinburgh Fringe have less hoops than going out on tour? Or doing, you know, sort of regular stand-up gigs?
I think... So this is a two-part question. Let me take that piece by piece. Okay, so I think regular gigging as a comedian is very, you know, I find it very lopsided in the UK versus on the mainland in Europe, for example, right? If you wanted to get a gig on the mainland, it's easy to show up at a club. If you're good enough, you graduate and you're like, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever. In the UK, it's far more difficult. I feel like you are at the mercy of club owners. And if you're a woman, it's even more difficult. If you are a parent with children and the mother, it's even more difficult. When it comes to the Fringe, I suppose one bit of privilege, you know, that I possibly have is the fact that I started as a writer, right? And therefore, the material was never, writing the material was never the challenge for me in the first instance. It was always the performance or the reaction to what the audience are thinking, or learning my tricks, to sort of deliver the best possible line at the best possible time, right? Because I am a bit of a motor mouth, right? This is because I'm Tamilian. We talk very fast. Our cadence of speech is sometimes it's too quick, I feel. So these are the things I've had to learn as a performer, you know, which I didn't have. But in saying that, I think I also had the privilege of, sort of being accepted at one of the biggest venues, right? I'm at the Underbelly, so it is a curated show. So I don't know the answer to whether the Fringe is easier than comedy clubs. I don't know the answer, because I think that is a very individual experience, you know, if you will. But I think gigging as a comedian is very challenging if you're a woman. That's all I know of universally. But I can't speak to whether it's easy or difficult with the Fringe. I've had a good experience, but I'm only in my second year. So maybe in 10 years, I'll be crying on your shoulder. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. But so far, so good. I don't feel, with all the challenges of, you know, not being able to afford anything, housing, just the overall costs of having to show up, I treat it like, you know, for me, at least in the first year, I saved up, you know, I said, okay, you know what, this is a huge milestone for me. It's something I'm very excited to do. And everything I do throughout the year is working towards that milestone, right? Whether it's working some extra hours. And to be honest, throughout the Fringe last year, I had a gig at night, right? I was working 4 hours at night to support myself. There was no other way. And that remains true this year too. So I don't take anything away from the fact that it's not an easy path. You know, I do feel very stretched in many ways. But at the same time, you know, I'm always looking at the artistic payload, and I feel like, you know, that's fine. You know, as long as I can justify that it's, you know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks of my time, and I have the privilege of this audience who are coming there for the art form, then I must make the most of it if I can. So,
I mean, one of the big questions that people listening to this are going to be is, how much of this is actually in the show?
I think Blimp is still sort of very much told from my perspective, right? It's a point of view of a woman going out and making art. So I feel like a lot of it is in the show, but it's a bit, it's told with a lighter touch, if you will. It's something that I talk about with as much boldness as I can, because, you know, unless I speak my truth, I feel like there's no moving on, you know, to the next thing, you know. I think Blimp is really a lot about a woman making art. And also in the film industry that I'm from, it's a muddle of mirrors, right? Because the whole world is saying that India is the third world, when in fact, it's the first world that seems far more regressive in some senses, you know, and we have a lot more women directors in India, but we don't have the permission to say what we want in some cases. So it's a very confusing sort of cornucopia of challenges to deal with, you know, and I feel like Blimp is talking a lot about Bollywood. It's talking about a lot about making films in the world. It's talking a lot about my experience as a South Indian woman making these films. You know, it's talking about having this weird in-between perspective, you know, where I think this joke has been done to death about the coconut, right? Where you're too brown for the white man and too white for the brown man. But I feel like that is something which has far more layering of your experience, if you will, right? You're talking about how you can't quite fit into any group, you know, and then what do you do? I mean, you're always constantly an in-betweener. And I think that's the richest place to find an artist is when they can't fit in, you know? So yeah, it's all about, probably it's all about not fitting in too. So yeah, a lot of it is in the show. A lot of, you know, my experiences are in the show for sure.
So BCAD is still touring?
BCAD is still touring. I made the amateur mistake of the first time comedian thinking that all shows end in a year, but apparently they don't. Because when you talk about children and parenting, I think it's very relatable. And I feel like that's the spark that's started the fire, you know, and I still have about 8 stops after the Fringe, you know, which I won't turn down because they are very good sort of places to sort of see how the room receives it, you know. So I feel like, yeah, it's still touring. But given that Blimp is a, you know, is still a bit of a new work, you know, it's something that I'm making with a fresh mind. It's a big challenge that I've set myself to find what's relatable, but also to tell a new story. You know, and hopefully I succeed and hopefully I don't, but you figure it out between the 2nd and the 19th.
And I'm looking down this CV list and, you know, I don't know if you have any engineering gigs coming up recently. But
I do. That's the 4 hours in the night, yeah, where we work across time zones and try to earn money. Yeah, absolutely. It pays the bills, you know. Comedy and filmmaking don't pay the bills. But you know, every artist was either a clockmaker or something else, right? So there's no escaping that, I think.
And the film project that you're working on just now, how close is that to any sort of public release or anything?
It's not close to public release, but it's very much based on Blimp. It's about the frustrations of a female filmmaker in this day and age. And also not wanting to be a diversity candidate. I think the protagonist in the film is very much drawn from, you know, a fictionalization of the sea. Live comedy and film are very different. We've discussed that. But I think you discover things about the character or yourself as you write and you perform. And I feel like the protagonist in the film is very much drawn from, you know, the protagonist in Blimp, right? Where we are talking about the same frustrations that she's going through, but it's a feature film. So it's something that will obviously draw on more elements of action and, you know, enlivening that specific situation. But it's very much about being an in-betweener, you know, in this world that demands loyalty to one thing. Just tell me the one thing you want, you know. Well, I don't have one thing, you know, I have 10 things. So yeah, I don't know if that makes sense, but the film is... We are trying to make a short film at the end of July as a proof of concept for the feature, which we'll pitch for money. And whether we get the money or not, hopefully, you know, we'll make some hodgepodge of it, you know, in the coming year. So we'll see.
And all of these things that you enjoy doing, where can people find it more about you, find about all these projects and watch and listen and experience everything?
I have a website. It's my name, anuvaidyanathan.com. It has a bit of a reel about film, a little bit about comedy, where you can find things and stuff like that. And on Instagram, I'm at anu.vaidyanathan and comedy.av because people find my last name difficult to spell. And Twitter is anuvaidyanathan.
We will have links to all of those, as well as a link into the Edinburgh Fringe box office to buy tickets for Blimp back at our website, edinburghfringe.thepodcastcorner.com. I will flag up that Blimp is not running the entire length of the Fringe. You're only running until the 19th, I believe.
Yes, 2nd to the 19th at 7:15 p.m.
So watch your diaries if you're making the booking. Anu, a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us on the show.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to come back. Because I think Scotland is very close to South India in some ways, although it rains and it's slightly colder. But
which is slightly colder, South India or Scotland? It's evergreen comment. Evergreen comment. Annie, once again, thanks very much.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Anu Vaidyanathan there, talking about her life in the arts. The show is Blimp, and as I said there in the interview and at the top, playing at the Underbelly from August the 2nd through to August the 19th. As always, there are links straight into the box office, so you can buy your tickets on the website or through the app at edinburghfringe.thepodcastcorner.com. We'll have a link to Anu's website there as well. The weekly previews are going to continue throughout July and until morale improves. Until we start speeding up when we get to those weekday shows running Monday through Friday during the Fringe itself when we get to August. The fact that you're listening means everything's working for you, but do feel free to link, like, love, share, subscribe, all the usual internet things to help boost a show. One thing you can do is you can leave a star rating, just like you would with any other Fringe show, in your favourite podcast app or directory. And if you want to spend the time to do a short review, tell people why you like the show, that would be very much appreciated as well. It helps other people find the podcast. It lets me know that everybody is enjoying the show. And it also means that the artists know that they're coming into a safe, welcoming and friendly space. So I'll say ta-ra for now. The previews will be back next week. I'm filling up my timetable of shows to see, tickets to buy and people to meet. And you're just going to have to wait until the next podcast for a little bit more. Ta-ra. You've been listening to the Edinburgh Fringe Show, hosted by Ewan Spence, produced by The Podcast Corner. Listen to more from The Fringe at edinburghfringe.thepodcastcorner.com.